You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll hear from Madison band Neens, who describe their sound as dream goth pop. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup. Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle made news during the Democrat-led sit-in at the U.S. House of Representatives this week, and a study came out looking at the effects of Act 10 on teacher salaries and union membership during the 5 years after that bill was passed. Rob Menzer joins us to talk about those stories and more. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first up this week, Democrats staged a sit-in in the U.S. House of Representatives to try to get a vote on some gun measures, and some Wisconsin representatives, of course, were involved. What do we know about that Wisconsin involvement?
Yeah, so this was quite the piece of political theater this week in the U.S. House of Representatives. This was, I mean, there were more than 200 Democrats on Wednesday overnight and into through most of Thursday that held this sit-in. So from Wisconsin, we saw there were, you know, selfies posted to social media from Representative Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore. They were joined by Senator Tammy Baldwin, who walked over to the House to show support for her colleagues over there, and at least for part of the time, Representative Ron Kind. So Wisconsin's Democrats were well represented at the big sit-in.
And Speaker Paul Ryan, of course, was there for part of that. And here's what he had to say.
If a person is on a terror watch list and they go try to buy a gun, we have procedures in place to deal with that. We want to make sure that those procedures are done correctly. And that's something we should be able to do in a calm and cool manner, without these sort of dilatory publicity stunt tactics to try and bring a bill that already died over in the Senate to the House floor.
And a clip there of House Speaker Paul Ryan. And Rob, what is your take on Paul Ryan's response?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's, you know, he's calling it a publicity stunt, which is clearly what it was. I mean, it was designed to create publicity around the House's lack of action on gun laws. It's just whether or not you feel that that is like a worthy of publicity probably depends on your stance on the underlying issue. So, I mean, it was an act of protest. It was counter to House rules. It was a sort of a mini government shutdown in that way. And those who support the action argue that extraordinary measures are required to get action on gun laws. But certainly, you know, it's not wrong to say that it was designed for publicity and designed to call attention to that they're breaking rules here.
And I think it was Paul Ryan who pointed out that in 2008, Republicans were in the minority party, and he said they did something similar and the lights got turned off. So it seems as though this can happen on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, and it's sort of not, you know, it's hard to feel great about the idea that this is just a tactic that is, you know, will become a sort of a standard political tactic in Congress. But you know, maybe that's, well, first of all, maybe that's where we are with a highly polarized Congress. But also it really gets to the frustration that folks on the sort of on the liberal side of the aisle feel about a lack of movement on gun laws. Some of these, you know, it does include measures that are broadly popular that have been brought up in the past. In this case, though, it's worth looking at what the sort of underlying substance of the bill is. Speaker Ryan referred to it in the clip you played. It's about barring people from the no-fly list from getting from being able to purchase a gun. And of course, the problem with that has been pointed out by people on the left and on the right, that there's no way to really appeal that. There's no sort of due process about getting on the no-fly list or getting yourself off of it, and it's kind of can be sort of arbitrary and unreliable in the first place. So there's been in addition to a lot of, you know, plaudits for Democrats who stood up in this way, there's been criticism that, you know, is this really the bill to sort of, is this the hill to fight and die on?
Now, over in the Senate, Senator Ron Johnson attempted to introduce an amendment to a bill on gun control, and here he is trying to gain support for it.
Here's something we can all agree on. Nobody in this chamber, no American, wants to see weapons transferred into the hands of terrorists or would-be terrorists. We can agree on that. We are so close. We are so close.
And Rob, what can you tell us about what Senator Ron Johnson had to say?
So Johnson had a bill that would have been rather weaker than the proposed Democratic ban on buying guns if you're on the no-fly list. It would have allowed the government to like delay firearm purchases. It would have been 3 business days. If you're on the no-fly list, you can't buy a gun for 3 whole days. Or it could be extended with a special appeal for a U.S. attorney, or it could ultimately be denied if a judge ruled that there's a reasonable basis to do so. So, you know, Senator Johnson's argument is that that introduces that element of due process that others say was missing. There was another similar bill introduced by Susan Collins of Maine, another Republican. And so there was an attempt to pass these bills. Neither one passed. Johnson got only 31 votes in favor of his bill. 67 senators opposed it. And the reason was it was too weak for the Democrats. They didn't think it was restrictive enough. But then he also lost a bunch of conservative Republicans who thought it was too, you know, that even that was still too restrictive.
We're talking to Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. We're getting our Wisconsin news roundup right now. And also in the news this week, a study came out looking at how salaries for teachers in Wisconsin have changed since Act 10. First off, where did the study come from?
Yeah, so this is a study from the Wisconsin Institute for Liberty and Law. So it's a conservative think tank, and you know the it should be understood as the product of a conservative think tank. But they did crunch some real numbers, and you can argue with their conclusions, or at least you know take it with a grain of salt. But what they did was they looked at data from the State Department of Public Instruction and from the Federal Department of Education to try to crunch the numbers on the effects of Act 10. One key, you know, a sort of a headline finding or a very interesting finding is they found that teachers in Wisconsin make overall $2,000 less in base pay today than they did before Act 10 5 years ago.
And there were other findings here. Essentially, the gist, it sounds like, of the findings was that the drastic changes that may have been foretold by critics of Act 10, they say, according to this study, didn't necessarily come to fruition. What were some of those other findings?
For sure. They tried to look at, for instance, class sizes. So class sizes didn't particularly increase. The overall experience level of Wisconsin's teaching workforce didn't significantly decrease. So, you know, there are trying to check claims that were made about what could happen, sort of mass migrations, loss of experience in the workforce, and they say that didn't happen. They also point out, I mean, it's a conservative group, they estimate that about $5 billion in savings to state taxpayers in the 5 years since the law passed. So there's sort of, you know, there's sort of something for everyone, right? You can focus on the way that that teacher salaries decrease as a potentially a negative outcome, or you can spin some of the data in a more positive sense as well.
And Rob, just super briefly as we wrap up here, less than a minute, but tell us about the conclusion of this story about that famous Iwo Jima photo and who the mystery Marine was in this.
Yeah, so the U.S. Marines finally reached a conclusion on this, and it was, in fact, not Wisconsin man John Bradley, a Navy man from Appleton and who lived in Anago. He was there, but he was not in the famous photo. He was he took part in the first flag raising on Iwo Jima, not the second. The Marine Corps thinks that it was a guy named Private First Class Harold Schultz. He died in 1995. He apparently never told anyone that he was actually the guy in this famous photo.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks so much.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He joins us every week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about the financial state of the Wisconsin farm after the recession. First, we continue our summer music series set list. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend. Today, we feature the Madison band Neens. They recently stopped by the WPR studio to play some music and reveal why their latest music video is a remake of the final scene of the 80s movie Pretty in Pink. Neems. Yeah?
Neens. Neens.
Yeah.
Shane Kyle Braden, thank you so much for coming into Wisconsin Public Radio and playing in our studios today.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
I want to start with the way you describe your band. So on your Facebook page, you describe yourself as dream goth pop.
Yeah.
Can you get it? Can you break that down for us? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, we're just playing our songs, you know. I mean, I do take the goth thing because I feel like I write from a little bit darker place. Experimental because I got this weird setup thing and I'm looping, and then, you know, I like to put big catchy hooks, so that's the pop and the experimental pop. Can you do that sound again for us?
So as long as we're playing the sound, while you were playing for us, you were using something called the Executive Stress Eliminator. It's apparently a vintage piece of, initially stress elimination equipment, but now you guys are purposing it for the sake of music. Tell us what it is and how you started using it.
Well, it was left at Kyle's house, and then I just started toying around with it, and I like ambient sounds. And it started relieving my stress, and so when I was playing these stressful songs, I just started playing this thing, and then it just
wow.
And means the name means uses and abuses technology, and so it kind of went hand in hand.
Nice, yeah. So I looked up Neen to see if there was actually a thing, and it is Urban Dictionary says pretty much what you say about the word Neen, art that abuses technology to create unexpected artistic results.
Yes.
Does that sound like you guys?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and the fourth definition, I was going to ask if that was also a play, which is apparently a person with unpleasant long hair.
So oh, that makes
I'm guessing
sense
that's
too,
not
yeah
it either.
Well, Braden had uncomfortably long hair, but he just recently got a haircut, but there's another meaning that says something about a girl who likes to eat cabbage and likes old people, and when asked to choose between cabbage and old people, she can't decide.
Okay, so officially we're going to go with the first definition here.
Yep.
Let's all decide on this.
I do like cabbage, though. Yeah, we'll go with the first one.
Let's go with the first one. Each of you bring to the band?
I would like to say I bring mysteriousnisms.
And, that's not a word.
mysteriousnisms for me, Braden.
Well, Braden, you play guitar. You bring that, electronics,
yeah,
too.
I play guitar and synth. I don't know. I think I've kind of taken the role of like the tech guy that
definitely
is always trying to, you know, kind of keep us all in line. There's a lot of equipment, too.
He made me buy a new guitar.
Yeah.
Jerk.
Yep.
And Kyle, what do you bring to the band?
Bass. I handle most of the low end, yeah.
So how do you put all those pieces together? How do you write your songs?
Well, the songs that we were playing for you guys, I wrote them kind of on a loop pedal because I was doing the one-man band thing. And these guys are talented enough to keep up with me and like to fill out that space and to follow the loops because they're not always perfect. I do everything live, so there's a lot of room for air all the time, and it's always like a big bubble in your stomach when we play because I can mess up at any time. These guys got a good ear, so they catch me and
I'm curious about that because you are you're looping, you're putting it together on the fly, and that's the foundation of the song that you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone to see Andrew Bird. I know he does a lot of that looping stuff too. And I've always wondered, how do you learn how to do that? It doesn't seem like it's something you would come across in your everyday course of life. Where did you pick it up?
I don't know. I never was that good at a certain instrument, and I always liked to write songs, and I was pretty much alone in Arizona. I felt alone, and so I was just trying to come up with how can I be my own band, and the loop pedal is what did it. And I like to write off like a simple beat, so minimalism is what, you know, I kind of strive for.
Have you ever just completely blown it when you've gone on stage, live show, people are there, and you just kind of mess up your loop?
Never. yeah, I mean, I've blown it, but I think if you see what I'm doing, I can't really take, you know, I'm gonna mess up, and people should appreciate that I'm doing something raw. You know, I'm not just hitting a button and I have this whole backing track. I'm playing it live, and you mess up. I mean, that's life. You gotta roll with the punches sometimes.
any of you have formal music training, or did you pick it up yourselves?
I was self-taught since about 8 years old. My dad bought me my first guitar. Just kind of learned playing by ear and then just went from there.
Yeah, my dad was a musician, and he never really encouraged being a musician. but I picked it up anyway, and I started playing guitar when I was like, I don't know, 12 or something. And then I moved to the drums and focused solely on that forever. But yeah, everything's self-taught. I mean, I have no clue what I'm doing.
I was a jock. I didn't start playing later, but my stepmom, she taught piano, so I always had to be quiet in my house, and I always wanted to play the drums, and I was like just always constantly moving when I was a kid, so I never got drums, but I got a set of congas, and then I started banging around those in the garage, and that kind of got me inspired to start writing from rhythms and stuff. And my dad plays harmonica, and he played blues growing up like that, so I was around music that, you know, really got me into it. I tried guitar lessons, but they would get too frustrated with me. I saw you out. Would you be friends? You ignored me, you brushed me on the shoulder. So I had another. Cause I was too high to socialize. Still ignoring me.
We were listening in the control booth while you were playing, and there are moments of it that sounded a little bit like 80s music, maybe Europop influences. Do you hear any of that in your music?
Definitely. I can list a lot of 80s bands that I love and freaked out. Like, I love The Cure and Joy Division, and I take influence from the 80s music and just the style and fashion. It's the 2000s, and for some reason, when I look back at 80s stuff, it seems more futuristic than what's going on now. So it definitely, I take influence from 80s stuff. We just did a video, and we redid the end scene of Pretty in Pink to go with that little 80s
classic
theme.
This is the iconic John Hughes movie. I love that movie.
Yeah.
How did you twist it? What did you do to make it your own?
Bad acting was definitely made it our own. We made it our own by getting everyone together. I can't believe we actually did it. It was a little bit more, you know, had to get like 60 extras. And it started because I would play my songs with old 80s kind of just overdubbing, just watching videos to the music to see if it kind of fits. And then we kind of just took that concept and basically redid that.
Were you a fan of the movie?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like one of my favorite movies, but it relates. Mm. It relates a bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we made it our own in a way, and that it's just kind of cool seeing our community, you know, our kind of east side of Madison community. Everybody's there pretty much that we know, and everybody's involved. And
like a family feel.
Yeah, it's, you know, everybody came together for it, so it was nice.
Yeah, every person kind of fit their character, which was hilarious to see, because you're like, oh, there's Ducky. And
But you guys didn't play the Ducky and the Molly Ringwald character.
I don't know. We kind of made up our own names, but, you know, I played the sad lover boy thing, and then we just had friends around the you know, community pick up different roles that we thought would fit.
Do when you're not making music? What are your you know, day jobs like?
I teach art, like second to high school. So art's a big part of my life, you know, visual, and I just try to keep myself surrounded by people involved in art and hang out with kids to keep my youth still alive.
Does that influence the band too, your work with kids and your work with art?
Being immature, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I think a lot of Shane's art also ties into what we do musically as well, so kind of goes hand in hand. Well, we have some themes that we've been doing as far as like we had two videos that were just released, and the second of which, working on a scheme, incorporates a lot of Shane's artwork, his Big Head series that he's done. It seems like at times the songwriting and the art that Shane comes up with kind of feeds off of each other almost.
it's hard to divide like my work life and art. It's just like I'm a maker, you know, I make things and create. I want to be creative and kind of live that sort of life, so.
And if we saw some of your art, would we look at it and go, oh, that's kind of dream goth pop art?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Definitely.
You got the video out there. What's on the horizon?
Just write new songs. I really want to do a full length, and it's really hard working, you know, 45, 50 hours a week and then, you know, cramming in art. It'd be nice to write a full length in a nice proper studio. We did this EP pretty much in friends' basements, and you know, it was all DIY stuff. It would be nice to really do something polished and really thought about and have percussion in it and real piano and really experiment with textures and things I imagine I want to be able to do, you know, in a proper setting and feel comfortable doing it.
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
That was the Madison Band Means. You can catch them July 15th in Madison at the Live on King Street concert series. Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist. Coming up, Wisconsin farmers are still struggling to repay debts after the recession. We'll learn more in just a minute. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight at 7, the Senate voted this week on gun legislation. Is it about guns or is it about politics? That's what Jennifer Steinhauer of the New York Times talks about as she assesses how the issue could play out in November. Plus a shakeup in the Trump campaign. That's coming up tonight at 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. First, for many residents in Wisconsin, farming is an integral part of the state's culture. But for many farmers, agriculture can be a financial gamble. One issue that highlights the problem is the growing amount of unpaid farm debt throughout the state, especially after the Great Recession. But how can that issue be resolved, and just how bad is it? We want to hear from you on this. Are you a farmer who's struggling to repay debts? Are you someone who wanted to be a farmer but thinks maybe agriculture is too risky? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your comments to talk@WPR.org. Joining us now to talk about the financial state of Wisconsin farms is Bruce L. Jones. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're also joined by Eric Goplin. He's a semi-retired farmer based just south of Osseo. Bruce and Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Bruce, I'm going to start with you. What is the state of debt for Wisconsin farmers collectively?
Well, it's always a challenge. We've got some debt out there. It's not as bad as it was in the 80s when we had the financial crisis. We have had some good earnings years. Farmers have used those profits to retire debt. But the problem is now that the prices are a little bit lower than we'd like to see. Yeah, we have some cash flow strains. People who've borrowed money are now looking at some challenges. The good news is the interest rates on those loans are a little more affordable than what they were, say, 20, 30 years ago. But still, when you're having cash flow problems, it's still a challenge.
Where do the cash flow problems stem from? What's changed?
Well, so over the course of 3 or 4 years, grain prices started falling in about 2012. After 2012, corn and soybean prices dropped. So that started translating into cash flow problems for grain farmers. Milk prices held and were pretty good until this past year. Then they dropped at a pretty significant rate, and they've stayed low this year. And so the cash flow problems of dairy farmers have been the last 2 years. And so that's showing up now in terms of a buildup of debt and a fallback in repayment rates.
So what do farmers and individual farms do when they have a cash flow problem and they need to keep up their operation costs?
Well, in the short run, they may go out and start pulling down cash reserves to stay current on their loans. So once they've exhausted those cash reserves, then they're going to have to start talking to their lender about an operating loan to stay current on the rest of their debts. There comes a point when we have to say, no, we can't continue to generate operating loans to provide that credit. And so the next step is to start trying to refinance some of your assets. And so if you own land and you've got equity in it, and the good news is there's a lot of equity available in the countryside due to for most farmers, they'll go in, renegotiate their mortgage, put the cash flow needs on a longer payout, and try to buy some or get some short-term relief. But that debt will only get repaid if cash flows recover. And so that's the gamble you're taking. You're saying, all right, I'm going to restructure my debt in the short run in hopes that things will improve, then I can pay these loans back.
Now, are those lines of credit, are the loans pretty easily accessible right now, or is it getting tougher?
As the cash flow problems continue, the lenders are going to have to be a little more cautious in extending the credit. And then once the prospects for a turnaround in prices start showing up, then they can start easing up on the credits that they would be extending. But right now, everybody's kind of in a hold and wait see mode.
We're talking about farm debt in Wisconsin right now with Bruce Jones, professor of agricultural and applied economics. And also joining us is Eric Goplin, a dairy farmer based south of Osseo. And Eric, I want to get you in on this conversation. Now, you've been a farmer for years. You're semi-retired now. Initially, why did you want to be a farmer?
Well, we have a very interesting situation here. Our farm has been in the family since 1870, and it was just something that I grew up with. My dad farmed, his dad farmed, et cetera, and it was just in my blood, and that's what I chose to do.
Do you see it as an economic gamble doing farming, or has it been a steady sort of income over the years?
Well, it's definitely a gamble every year. You've got things beyond your control, the usual prices, weather, absolutely always weather. And that's always there. Just, I guess I personally, we just sort of played it cautious all the time and made it. I've seen a lot. The inflation of the early and mid-70s, the high interest rates of the early 80s, the drought of 88, that was an experience. And then some more roller coasters in the 90s and until now.
What is it like weathering some of those storms that you talked about in the 80s, especially? You talked about the drought. What is it like to be a farmer when you have those moments where there are factors that are, frankly, just outside of your control?
In 1988, of course, I had my dad to refer back to because he farmed in the 30s. So he knew all about the drought. And that was really a just exist type mode. I mean, they released acres for CRP, so we got forage enough to get the cows through. But I mean, we skimped, we really did, but we survived, so.
And it was rewarding enough that even though you had these moments, you wanted to keep going. It sounds like it was a way of life for you.
Well, absolutely, it's a way of life. And I have to say, too, that I married well. We had off-farm income, so that always helps, too, to keep the household going and those type of things. So, but, yeah, it's definitely in my blood and in my son's, too, obviously. So,
And Bruce, Eric describing some tough times over the years. Obviously, he loves it and didn't want to give it up. But what is it that keeps farmers going when the going gets rough? And what happens when they decide they've had enough?
Well, what keeps them going is that they're trying to keep a family business going. I think it's a lot of the incentive that they're seeing the challenge of trying to make sure that this thing's successful. And they see, like you said, you have to be a little optimistic to be a farmer. And so you say, all right, 88's a challenge, but it's got to be better than 89. If I can get through 88, I'll see better times. And they came. The other thing you do is you're thinking, all right, when is the time to pass it on? If you got another generation that's ready to take over the farm business, you start transitioning them in, starting giving them more management responsibilities. You may become the person who owns the land, but helps becomes the landlord for the next generation, etc. But then there comes a time when you've either going to turn it over to the next generation, or you start saying, no, there's other things I want to do. I'm going to sell the farm, and I'm going to use that equity to do some other things.
Are we at the point, you mentioned the debt problem, a cash flow problem for farmers right now. Are we at the point, Bruce, where you think we could start to see some of these farmers and farm families having to get out of the farming business?
Those things happen all the time, not just here, but in these times, but they've been going out in other times as well. And so, the challenge becomes, picking the right time if I can still refinance this farm and I can continue to cash flow this thing, I'll keep going. But yeah, there will be some times when just through natural catastrophes and bad events, you just can't extend the credit anymore. And the idea is to make sure that you can work through the situation so that the family is not put in dire straits, that rather there's some equities there to live on and start transitioning to a different life.
Well, I want to ask you both this question. Do you see, we'll start with you, Bruce, do you see the moment that we're in now with these low commodity prices and rising debt? Do you see this as a sort of similar to the bumps in the road that we've been talking about that Eric mentioned, or do you see anything different about this that could be more concerning?
No, this is what we've got through things like this before. The question is the duration. I mean, we're dealing with low cash flow. The question is, are we going to see a rebound? If we start seeing cash grain prices recover, if we start seeing milk prices recover, we start seeing cash flows improve, we work our way through this. The other thing to note is that there is a lot of equity in the countryside. We can see land prices start dropping in value and still not have persons inadequately secured to the point that they can get loans. And so we've got the means to work through this. The question is how long we're going to be dealing with it.
And Eric, what would you say? How would you frame the particular moment in farming right now with these low prices and the debt rising?
I would agree with Bruce that it's definitely a part of the game of farming. Interesting to note, I have a chart from the Upper Midwest Marketing, and milk, which is right now $12.10 to $12.40, first hit $12 a hundredweight in 1980. So these are things you hate to see it happen, but this is something that does happen, and yes, the duration, that also is something that could really hurt you. With that said, the futures I did read now are going to get up to 16, so that'll help. And as far as debt, if you can, you just have to be resourceful and try and think things differently than trying to just to go borrow more money. But on that note, always be in contact with your lender and let them know what's happening and what your intentions are. And I think pretty much it always works out to the good.
We're talking about the growing debt that farmers face in Wisconsin right now with low commodity prices. And we're joined by Bruce L. Jones, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, and Eric Goplin, a farmer based just south of Osseo. And we want to hear from you on this. Are you a farmer who's struggling with debt? What relief could you use financially, and do you see it on the horizon? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about the growing concerns surrounding the growing debt for farmers, especially following the Great Recession. And we want to hear from you. Are you a farmer who maybe wanted to expand operations and is now having a hard time paying off that debt? What has that experience been like? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Brucell Jones is with us now, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. We're also joined by Eric Goplin. He's a semi-retired farmer based just south of Osseo. He runs a dairy farm. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Patty on the line in Lake Mills. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Veronica. I'm a dairy farmer in Lake Mills, and I just wanted to call in to discuss what we're trying to do on our farm. When the years were good in 2014 and the beginning of 2015, that's when we bought newer equipment and things like that, and we were able to just pay as we go. We didn't have to take out a loan on any of those. But then for, like, to feed the cows, we buy in a lot of our commodities, and we try to forward contract a lot of things. That way we keep our feed costs low for the cows, and we just play smart. Right now we're not buying any equipment, and we're not trying to do any major expansions until we see a brighter future for milk and grain.
And so far, Patty, is what you're describing, is it interfering with the running of the farm, or is it more of a tightening of the belt?
We're tightening our belts. We try to plan ahead. We know we'll have a bad year, so we try to position ourselves to be better for these bad years. My husband and I were younger generation that joined the farm, and so we do have some heavy land payments that we bought 500 acres, and we're trying to pay that off. And so we, you know, that portion has to get paid every month, and we try to make sure we have enough for that, and then allow money everywhere else, wherever our debts are.
Patty, thank you so much for calling and sharing your family farm's experience with us, and good luck to you. And Bruce, what do you hear when you listen to Patty's story?
Patty is very representative of what's gone on in many farms across the state, that when people were generating profit, they were retiring debt or salting away cash reserves, or they were making capital improvements in anticipation that this was the time to do it. And so now what they're going to do is say, now the cash flow is not as strong. Now we're going to postpone any capital purchases that could be the potential problems for us. And then we're going to work our way through it. Then when prices improve, then we'll start building back cash reserves and anticipating another year like this.
Patty, thanks a lot. We go next to Clarence, joining us in Watertown. Hi, Clarence.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Professor Jones. I've heard you speak a number of different times at extension seminars and stuff here in Jefferson County. He is the person that told me to value my own time. I hadn't put much of a value on my time when I was much, much younger. But, we're in the dairy industry. We are caught at very, very low negative returns, really. But, this is not something you get in and get out of. And as I told you, we are trying to transition to the next generation. We got one of our children started in farming, and we're working on getting another one started. They're working for basically starvation wages in exchange for equity in the cattle, and that will give them some leverage when they go to the bank and say, you know, they need money to work into the operation. But I really feel consumers don't understand the risks we take and the low pay level, and actually you're basically working for nothing. Many wives go off the farm to get a job for nothing else, for the health insurance, because we can't afford it. You know, we have to pay all our own. Ours was $1,400 a month.
Clarence, thank you so much for sharing what you've gone through. And got a couple new generations, his kids coming up in farming. We're hearing that also with you, Eric. So in these tough times that Clarence is describing, Is that something that has resonance with you about why farmers stay in it and what it means to get that next generation? And even though it might not be the most lucrative job you could choose, it is farming. It's what people choose here in Wisconsin a lot of the time. So, Eric, what do you hear in Clarence?
Well, yeah, both Patty and Clarence, I hear all that they say, and I echo everything that they say also. I mean, it's just, it's the same. To get the next generation, it's a thought process, it's sacrifice, it's hard work, the starvation wages, I sort of got a chuckle out of that, yeah, that's part of it too. And with my son, he is currently paying for the personal property. He doesn't own the farm yet, so he's renting the farm. And he, like in 2014, yeah, he was in the good, you know, and now it's gone the other way. So he's experiencing that too now. So, but he's still making a go of it. So good luck to you, Patty and Clarence. I feel for you.
And Eric, just briefly before we go to our next call, I mean, both you and Clarence, we just heard from, both have family members willing to step up of the next generation children. Is that typical? Do you think, are farming families able to get the next generation involved usually?
Well, what I see around here in Osseo is there is a genuine movement for young men wanting to farm and trying to come up with any way possible to do it. They love farming. They grew up on the farm, and they want to see it make it work. So I think it's something that maybe might come to fruition as far as another generation taking a hold and getting it done.
Eric, thanks. And Bruce, you looked like you wanted to chime in there.
Well, I want to just make a point about the challenges that farm families have when they're trying to pay themselves. That when they make that loan payment on the mortgage, they're building equity, but they don't have the cash to start covering family living expenses. And so one of the dilemmas and frustrations that the farm families feel is they're building equity, that they're increasing their wealth, but they don't have a lot of cash to work with because the wealth is in the form of land and cows and things like that. And so a farmer told me years ago that farmers will live paupers and die millionaires. And boy, he was right on in terms of the situation that people face.
Another quick call. Mike from Poinette. Mike, hi.
Hi, I was just calling to ask, you know, there are a couple industries like banking and farming that seem to go through these long boom times, but then when the bust time comes, they don't seem to endure it as long as you would think, given that they were making $9 a bushel in corn or, you know, billions of dollars over the years before. And so I'm wondering, with the infrastructure that farming has, the farm bill, crop insurance, why is it that these bust times, you sound the alarm right away when for years money has been made?
Mike, thanks for that. And Bruce, very briefly in our last minute, how would you respond to that?
Well, I'd say a lot of farmers back in 2011, 12, 13, when they were generating strong profits, were in fact retiring debt, were in fact building cash reserves. And so this past year, cash grain farmers for a couple of years have been drawing down those reserves, so they're starting to borrow money. So they anticipate these things. It's just that the cycle has been that they built some reserves, and then they had to use them right away.
Well, thank you a lot for that call and for all the calls. And remember, if you couldn't make it on the air, please go on the Central Time Facebook page and let us know what you think over there. And Bruce and Eric, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
That was Bruce L. Jones, Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Also joining us, Eric Goplin, semi-retired farmer based just south of Osseo. They were joining us there to talk about farm debt in the state of Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.